great pleasure today to welcome all of you to International Careers Day and extend also a very warm welcome to our speakers. And we'll introduce them briefly. First, we have Hugh Davis from the European Personnel Selection Office. Hugh is actually on kind of secondment from the UK Civil Service Fast Stream. He'll talk more about that too. And we then have Florian Seitz, who is First Secretary Culture and Education from the German Embassy in London, and Alina Meyer, who is on leave from the Canadian Foreign Service and also works as an independent consultant. I will ask them all to talk informally about their career paths, experiences, and give any advice to those of you really wanting to get into these kinds of roles in this sector. They'll talk for no more than 10 minutes each so that we can take some questions at the end, which I will chair. So all questions will be at the end. Okay, so Hugh, if I could ask you to pick up.
My name's Hugh Davis. As Jane said, I'm on loan from the UK Civil Service Fast Stream. My job at the moment within the Commission is for the Personnel Selection Office, and I manage the team which is responsible for promoting careers with the EU across Europe. So I'll talk a bit more about that at the end and sort of how you can actually apply for an EU career. My career path, how I've ended up where I am. After university, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I went to the civil service. That's the general path. If you ask many civil servants how they ended up there, it's exactly like that. I just did a temporary contract, worked in statistics and in education, so not an area that I'd had any background in. I'd done a degree in philosophy, which doesn't really relate to anything or everything, depending on which way you look at it. And so I started on a temporary contract, found the work interesting, found the environment interesting. I was based in the Welsh Assembly government in Cardiff. And I decided I wanted a career there. I spoke to my friends who were working in banking, who were working in law firms, and I wanted more of a balance to my life. I wanted to stay in the civil service where I could have that balance. I could do interesting work that could make a difference, but also have some spare time and have a social life as well, which has a bad effect if I have a social life on a Friday night before coming to an international careers fair. But still, it's a nice option to have. So I carried on enjoying the civil service, and I applied for the civil service fast stream. I applied for the general scheme, which means that you can work in any department on any policy area, project management. You might be aware of that already. There's different areas as well for economists, for diplomats, if you want to work in the foreign service. And now they've restarted the European fast stream, which is to get sort of, I think it's about a dozen people each year who they will train specifically to go on and apply for an EU career. I didn't go through that, so I know a bit about it because I work with some of the people on that. So if you've got any questions about that later, I can try and answer those as well. But that's just been running for a couple of years now. So I was then on the generalist fast stream. I based myself in the Welsh Assembly government. More out of choice, really, because I was aware that in the Welsh Assembly government, in the Scottish government, in the Northern Irish Assembly, you can move around more easily. If you're in Whitehall, it's quite difficult if you're in the Home Office or in the Treasury or in DWP to then move to another department because of how they centralise or how they divide up the fast stream budgets. Whereas in the Welsh Assembly, I started off working in education policy. I then went to be a private secretary for two different ministers, for the Environment Minister and the First Minister for Wales. And then I worked managing the renewable energy strategy. So all under one roof, I was able to do all the different jobs, work in different policy areas and try and get an idea where I wanted to end up working. And then luckily I got the chance to go on secondment to the European Commission. And almost 2 years ago now, I went over to Brussels for a 5 month secondment, and I was based in the Cabinet, which is like the private office of Baroness Ashton when she was Trade Commissioner. So I got to work on trade issues as well. And all this from someone who did a philosophy degree. It's a bit ridiculous and a bit worrying that someone like me could end up in these positions, but it's still quite interesting. From there, I sort of made contacts. And one thing to learn about sort of the European political environment, about Brussels, about Luxembourg, contacts definitely help. Once you get there and once you know people, once you know different areas, it works like that. It definitely helps to know different people. So then it was suggested to me that they wanted someone British to be doing the job I'm doing now. because the UK is the country where we have the biggest problem in terms of applicants from, we don't get enough applicants. The UK is about 12% of the EU population, but last year we only had 1.5% of the applicants from the UK, the same number as the Netherlands. And from that through to the final stage of assessment, we only had 15 people from the UK. So there's a severe problem with underrepresentation. Part of that is a lack of awareness, and that's why I come to events like this, to let people know. Because the FCO, we worked with them, and they did a survey of about 2,500 students across the UK, and 80% of them said they had no idea about how to apply for an EU career, just no idea about them generally. But then about 55-60% said that, in theory, they would be interested in working with EU institutions. So there's a real lack of knowledge there, lack of awareness, and that's part of my role, to really sort of promote it around the UK, but also in other countries where we have problems getting people applying. So I don't just work for the UK, I work in Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, get to travel quite a lot with my work. Last year I went to Budapest, to Vienna, and that's one of the great things working for the European institutions, because they are international organisations. It inevitably means that not only on a daily basis will you be working with people from multiple nationalities for different cultural backgrounds, you also get the opportunity to travel in most jobs. 80% of the jobs are based in Brussels or Luxembourg, so you should expect, if you do apply for a career with the EU, to be based there at some stage, usually especially for your first placement. It's a bit like the UK Fast Stream or Civil Service. You'd expect to be based in London at some point. And you might think, Brussels, London, you can't really compare the two. But Brussels is great. I've been there 2 years. I want to stay there longer. Everyone I know who's lived there, who's then moved back to London, just says you can't compare the quality of life. The rent is much lower, you can walk to work, you get all the same bands, all the same tours coming to the city, but it's much cheaper. I can see gigs where it would normally be in a massive venue in sort of a room half this size and pay about €10 for a ticket. And the same if you're into art, the same sort of exhibitions tour and come to Brussels as well. So it's a great place to live. I hope I'm not overselling it too much. If you do want to apply for a career with the EU, there's opportunities for everyone, not just idiots who did philosophy like me, but people who've got real specialist qualifications. We need lawyers, we need economists, we need tax experts, financial experts, all sorts of people, statisticians. And our main graduate recruitment is every March. We've brought in a new cycle to make it more predictable. It's quite obvious, and it's what all the other recruiters have done, but we haven't done it for years, and we've just introduced it last year. So every year, every March or every spring, there'll be a main graduate recruitment, and you can also apply for that from now in your final year. The basic eligibility are you do need to be an EU citizen, and also you'll need to speak two EU languages. The language of the second stage of assessment needs to be done in English, French or German, but not your first language. So if you speak English and Spanish, it's a bit difficult. Unless you speak Spanish to such a level, you could put Spanish as your main language. There's no cross-referencing of language against nationality. So you could be British, speak Spanish and English fluently, and choose Spanish as your first language. But the thing to bear in mind is the first stage of the assessment, so these are reasoning tests like you would do with the Fast Stream, like you would do with most graduate recruitments, abstract reasoning, verbal reasoning, you do that in your main language. So you can do that stage in English, see how you get on, and then if you get through to the next stage, you've got 2 or 3 months to revise for the final stage. I'm definitely sort of talking more about how to apply rather than my own career, but if you've got questions about my career and what I've done, then we'll go to that at the end.
Okay? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, so my name is Florian Seitz. I'm working for the Federal Foreign Office of Germany. I'm very honored to be here today. It's my first time in Oxford, but I have a good excuse. I moved to London only 2 months ago, so was a little bit absorbed by the buzz of London and couldn't get to Oxford, but I'm terribly excited to be here for the first time. I just want to tell you in a few words something about my personal career path before going on to how to apply for the German Federal Foreign Service. Me, I've joined the Federal Foreign Office in 2003, so 7 years ago. I'm a lawyer. I studied law in Berlin and Paris. And after graduating from law school, I had mainly the same problem as you. So I didn't know what to do with my life, and I just thought, let's try it out. It could work, and finally it worked. You have to pass an entry exam, which comprises several stages. And it was a small surprise for me. And I would say you cannot predict that you are accepted finally, because I think last year we had the total number of applicants were roughly 2,000, and they will take in a year 40 of them. So it's quite, it's not only depending on you, it's quite something which is beyond you. As I mean, you play a major role and an important part, but there are also other factors which are quite important. So I would, at the very beginning, already give you the advice to have always an option, because you cannot plan it. So it comes to you, or it doesn't come to you. So you should see it as one option, but not as the only one. I've seen a lot of people who thought, I would like to do it, and I just was concentrating on it, and it's really what I want to do in my future life, and they didn't get it, maybe because they were too much focus on this only option. So you have to look around a little bit, but nonetheless, I don't want to discourage you. It's an option, and it's an option which is great fun, and which till today I really enjoy a lot. So to tell a little bit about my career, I started in 2003, then we have a diplomatic academy. So even though you have already studied and you graduated from university, you have to join the academy with your colleagues, with the 40 other colleagues who are selected in the selection procedure. And then you have a wide range of different topics: history, economics, politics, consular law, legal law. You have some very practical trainings, how to communicate with media, how to present yourself, how to write reports, how to draft speeches for ministers, and so on. And after this year of training, you have to pass another exam, and once you passed it, you are really appointed and you are really in the service. After having passed this exam, I was appointed to Russia, to St. Petersburg, where I worked for 3 years. I was there responsible for the culture and press department as the head of the department, as the consulate general there, because it's not the capital, obviously. And it was a very small department, besides me, another 3 people. But from the very beginning, you have responsibility for staff, for local staff, and for posted staff from Germany, and you are responsible for a certain budget. And so for me, it was quite an interesting time, because you have to get used to a new surrounding, to a new life, to a new lifestyle also in a way, and then on the other hand, you have all these new professional aspects. And it comes very quickly, so that was the way I felt it at this time. But you get used to it also quite smoothly, so maybe half a year was a little bit irritated, and I thought, so where I am now, what I am doing here, what is my new job? But then, you have colleagues and they will show you. So I worked 3 years in Russia, and then I moved back to Germany, to Berlin, to the headquarters, to the Federal Foreign Office, where you have to move back at a certain stage of your career. I worked there in the policy department at the OSCE desk, or more precisely, desk for OSCE and Council of Europe matters. And it was a completely different work. Also very interesting, but really was a big difference from my very practical work back in the consulate. And then I took time off. I went on paternity leave because in Germany we have a great new law which allows also young fathers to go on paternity leave for up to 1 year with almost full salary. So I took advantage of this and became a father, which was quite exciting too. And so then with my whole family and me, we moved to London at the end of this year. So I'm really here for now 1.5 months. And that was very exciting too, because when you decide to become a career diplomat, I mean, mostly you are quite young. So you are under 30, probably you are in your 20s, and you are independent and you can decide very autonomously what you want to do. But that will change rapidly, so as I experienced. And when you have not only a wife, in my case, or a man or a partner or whatever, and then also a family, things that were quite easy formally became quite difficult. And you have to keep in your mind a lot of aspects, and you get support from your ministry, and you get an allowance, for instance, to live here in London, which is quite expensive, as you all know. But however, at the end, it's you who has to decide what to do, where to live. And now it's okay, because our boy is quite small. But once it become he has to go to the school, you are already very restricted, because if you want to send him to a German school, you should live somewhere around the German school, which is in Richmond here in London. So it's not, I mean, you feel it at the very beginning like the total freedom, and you think, okay, I can work everywhere in the world and that's great. And in a way it is like this, but don't underestimate, I just wanted to give you that advice, the factor which is stemming from all your family situation, from the situation of your partner, who perhaps also likes to have an own professional career, and who is forced at the end to disrupt it. I mean, I know hardly any example where a partner could, if he's not also working for the Federal Foreign Office, could really pursue consistently his own career. So there are a lot of aspects, and in this really, as I told you, terribly interesting work, but that is an important aspect too. So I'm already overstretched my time, probably.
Spot no? on, Florian.
Yeah? Okay.
Thank
so
you.
If you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer.
Thank you. And I have a lot to say, and I won't be able to pack it into 10 minutes, so please feel free to come up afterwards and ask questions. I think I'm going to go through my career path to start with. I have lots of advice as well, but if we get to that, we'll do that at the end. But I think when I look at my career path, it really was quite a meandering one. And it might be useful for you guys to see how I meandered, because I'm sure you have similar interests. And so I'm going to go over it really quickly. Basically, I started when I was doing my undergrad at McGill University in Montreal, Quebec. I decided I was really enjoying being a student, but I wanted already to get some career experience, which would kind of give me a head start. So I ended up doing an internship 3 days a week full time, which was quite a serious internship, at the United States Consulate General. So it's not an embassy. If it's not in a capital city, it's called a consulate. So I worked at the US Consulate General in Montreal in their commercial services, learning about US business, US foreign policy. And so when I graduated from McGill, it kind of really helped me, because I basically was able to get a job first as a summer student, but then they kept me on full time in the United States Relations Division at the Canadian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So we have a huge division, as you can imagine, because our bilateral relationship is very important, the US-Canada relationship. And because I already had sort of this experience of working for the US government, even though I was just a student still, it really lent well for to this role of doing US foreign policy for the Canadians. So I started doing that as a summer student, and then I had to sort of fight when I got my degree from McGill for them to give me a better salary, because I wasn't a summer student anymore and they wanted to keep paying me as a student. But anyways, it's an uphill battle sometimes when you're young and new to the workforce, especially to a big bureaucracy like the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But basically, I was able to stay there in a full-time capacity. Well, I was a sort of summer student, then a contractor, and then they offered me a full-time job. But I didn't end up taking it, actually. I mean, I'm now back at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but it was a very circuitous route. I really wanted to go to Japan, and I'd applied to do the JET program to teach English there. Anyways, I didn't end up doing the JET program, but I did go to Japan because I got an opportunity to work in the UN University, which is a branch of the United Nations based in Tokyo, and it's kind of the think tank wing of the UN, and they also offer courses, which are, if you're interested in, they do some interesting diploma courses as well in foreign policy and other areas. So I worked in the Peace and Governance program there at the UN University, and that was an internship again. And Tokyo, like London, is a frightfully expensive city to live in. So I ended up, to make some money, tutoring Japanese on the side, and I also got a short contract at the Canadian Embassy in Tokyo, which I'm sure my experience at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs sort of helped me to get that. So I did that for about, I guess it was 9 months. And then I decided I was really into foreign policy and international relations, but the thing that sort of I was most passionate about was the human element of that. And so I was trying to figure out how do I sort of pursue my interest in foreign policy and foreign relations, but also my interest in sort of social justice and sort of the human side of all of this. So I basically ended up applying to a gazillion internships in Geneva, and I tried to apply to ones that were more human rights focused. So I ended up at a small NGO in Geneva called the International Service for Human Rights, where I was able to sit in on sort of all sorts of UN commissions and committee meetings, the Human Rights Council, and learn firsthand about the processes of government, but also the UN and its workings and its mechanisms, especially in terms of human rights. So when I was doing that, I applied for a human rights program at the London School of Economics. There weren't many at the time that had human rights courses. So I ended up going to the LSE and doing the Human Rights Masters there. And while I was there, I was recruited back again into the Canadian government through a program called the Recruitment of Policy Leaders Program. It's called RPL for short. And if you have more questions, I'm happy to tell you about that. But basically, it was a program that aimed to sort of bring back Canadian talent. They went to schools abroad, found people who were on scholarships or, you know, had a relevant policy background, and came and brought them back at sort of mid to senior level policy analysts for the Canadian government. So I was at LSE at the time, but I interviewed at the High Commission here, and they flew me back for interviews. And I said, yeah, I really want to do this, but I want to do a few other things first. So I was able to put that on hold for a year, and I won a stipend to do another internship, but at least this one was paid because I won a stipend, at UNESCO headquarters in Paris. And again, trying to sort of build that human rights career a little bit for myself. So I worked in the Gender Equality and Human Rights Division at UNESCO, which is a whole other story because it's a highly dysfunctional organization, but it was a good learning opportunity. And especially if you can get a paid internship. I know there's so many internships out there and it's really tricky because they're so expensive, but I really do recommend them because I was just looking back at my career path and I actually did 4 internships, one of which this one at UNESCO was paid. But it's really hard to suck it up and live in expensive cities. It's really tricky, and I think there's a lot of problems with the unpaid internship sector. But the truth is, when I look back, the 4 internships I did really did help me to build my career. So I would encourage you. It's hard, you know, swallow your pride, but if you know you're really passionate about a certain area, it's kind of worth it to suck it up and do the unpaid work, because often it does lead to paid work or offers of consultancy, or you just make connections that will really help you in the long run. So anyways, after UNESCO, I did go back to the Canadian government, as I'd promised, and I ended up working at CEDA, which is the Canadian equivalent of DFID, or USAID. So it's our Agency for International Development. And I worked there as a senior policy analyst doing the OECD DAC file. So I don't know if you guys know the OECD. It's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's based in Paris. And the DAC is the Development Assistance Committee. So it's the development wing of that organization. So I basically controlled, sort of tried to represent Canada and at that committee, but from Ottawa, so coordinating our policy in Paris at the OECD. And then I switched and I was a senior development officer working on human rights programming in the Americas region. So again, trying to build the human rights side, but also kind of getting into development work. So I don't have a master's in development studies, but I basically have the equivalent of that, I feel, in terms of what I learned on the job in terms of international development. So I enjoyed CEDA, but for personal reasons, I had a British partner at the time, wanted to come back to London, and I miss London too. So I ended up getting a job at the Commonwealth Secretariat, which is the headquarters for the Commonwealth, and it's based in London in this beautiful palace on Pall Mall. So I worked there for a while in their human rights unit. And then I wanted to go back to sort of more development-focused work. So I ended up working at DFID. And it was interesting because I didn't have any connections at DFID, didn't know anyone. And people keep asking me, how did you get into DFID? So if you want to know, come ask me afterwards and I'll tell you. But basically, I ended up working there as a consultant and as a part-time employee for a while, basically the equivalent of a whole year, in their equity and rights team. There were very few people there working on human rights policy, and they needed more. So I ended up doing really interesting human rights policy work for DFID. So having represented the Canadian government, I was then representing the UK government at international fora, like meetings of the UN in Geneva, etc. So that was a really interesting experience. But then that consultancy expired, and then I came to Oxford and did another master's degree in social anthropology, which was really great. And I highly recommend going back to school once you've had some career experience, because I think not only is it easier to get into really good competitive programs, but it brings a whole other dimension to your studies. And I just feel like you get a lot more out of it sometimes once you've had a couple years of work under your belt. So I would highly recommend that route, taking some time off to work before you do more higher education. But yeah, keep going back to school. It's a great learning experience, and it is really different than the learning you'll do on the job. So basically, yeah, did a year at Oxford, and now I still, sorry, one thing I forgot about the Foreign Service. When I got in through this policy leaders program in Canada, there was an option, which was rare, but they did it once in a while, to bring people who were already in the public service into the Foreign Service through a lateral entry program. So instead of starting at the bottom, which usually in every Foreign Service all over the world you have to do, they're quite strict about that, you were able to come in at a mid to senior level. There was still a competition, series of essays, and a process, but basically they took seven people outside of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to come in as diplomats, and I was one of them. So I was really lucky that way, because the Foreign Service was something I was super interested in, but after all the work I'd done, I kind of didn't want to start at entry level. So, but by the time I'd gone into that, I was already back in the UK, because as Hugh was saying, these government processes can take forever. This one took, I think, almost a year and a half. So I'd already moved back to London. I thought, well, but anyways, the good thing with the Canadian government is there's a lot of flexibility in terms of personal leave, leaves of absences, and I was basically in this pool. And so I was able to stay on my leave and still keep my job back home, which is a very lucky scenario. But that is one good thing with government. Often they do have educational leave, personal leave, spousal leave, maternity, paternity leave. There's more flexibility built into government work than you would think initially. So basically, I've got the job, the Foreign Service job, waiting for me in Ottawa. And I'm putting it off for a little longer because, for personal reasons, I really want to be in London. So I've been trying to do some independent consulting work. And so currently, I'm doing some work for the UN, writing a report for them on gender and volunteerism. But I will go back to the Canadian Foreign Service because I think in the long run, it's a really good career path for me, and there's lots of sort of mobility within a framework of stability, which I think would probably appeal to some of you guys because it's pretty much a permanent job. But within that job, you can do so many different jobs on different postings in different areas and different departments. So that's my very meandering career path. Am I out of time, Jane, or I'm out of time?
30 seconds,
okay. I wanted to just give you guys a little advice because I've done a lot of thinking about my career over the years. Well, one piece of advice is that everything is cumulative. You know, when I look back, that one little internship at the U.S. Consulate General kind of led to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs job in the U.S. Relations Division, which led to the other stuff. I mean, even if what you see is a little thing, I mean, if it looks like a little thing, a little internship or, you know, a small consultancy, everything is really snowballs. So make sure you keep that in mind. It's all about building up. And also that people have different approaches to building a career. I have some friends who graduated from undergrad or for their master's and just right away went to one organization and stayed there and moved up within that organization. And instead, I kind of moved a lot laterally within a whole variety of organizations that interested me. And there's no path, it's not that one is better than the other, there's just very different approaches to how you build a career. And it kind of depends on where you're at and what you want to do and what interests you. But really see the next couple of years once you guys graduate as an educational experience, because positive or negative, I definitely learned from every job and every internship, and I learned what I wanted and what I didn't want out of a career, and I think that's really important. And this is the time in your life where you can do that. I mean, I have so many friends that, you know, mid-career now are saying, oh, I shouldn't have done this. I actually really hate law. I really hate diplomacy. So, I mean, this is the time to explore those options. You know, you have time. It's a luxury. So take that time to really explore, and don't be afraid to be an idealist. I mean, God, if you can't be one now, when are you ever going to be able to be an idealist? Pursue things you're passionate about and take that time to explore. And better that you ask yourself these questions now than, you know, when you're 55 and have your midlife crisis. So, yeah, I'll finish on that note.